You've probably used to seeing bugs crawl through the grass and on your plants outside, and it's not going to be too long before a few of them are going to be crawling inside, or trying to at least. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we talk the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, Distinguished Faculty Associate, Emeritus Faculty Associate at the UW-Madison. He had headed. So he headed the insect diagnostic lab at UW for a long, long time, and it's always great to have him back. Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
We have lots of things we can talk about, and certainly as our listeners, as you listen to Phil and I talk, you may have a question of your own. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the place to go. And we've got some fall home-invading bugs that I guess we can expect to see.
To me, one of the most critical dates always is when the first frost comes. And so we didn't see it in the southern third of the state, but they did in the north. And
yep.
To me, that is the trigger that often brings in Asian lady beetles, not so much cluster flies. The box elder bugs are going to start going. And the one that I had been watching towards the end of my career, and now PJ Leash, who's running the lab, is keeping me abreast, is the one that's caused so much havoc out east called the brown marmorated stink bug.
Yeah.
And so PJ has posted a picture of how you can separate this stink bug from our native stink bugs. But the one I find a little humorous is 8 of these critters have shown up in our chairman, Susan Paskowitz's, home in the past week. And that may be a record, because we've seen kind of a trickle of 1 or 2 before. We have not seen the agricultural damage yet. But when this thing gets rocking and rolling, it's just like Asian lady beetle. It comes in by the buckets full, and it's a very unpleasant odor to it. And as I said, it's an insect that we're not looking forward to. And so far, I've been cautiously optimistic, and I'm still cautiously optimistic because we've not been overrun. But it definitely seems to be picking up momentum.
And PJ posted that photo on our Facebook page. So if you go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you get a nice photo with all of the sort of the characteristics identified as how you can distinguish it.
Yeah, it's got some markings on the antenna. It has a very smooth shoulder. It's got some markings on the abdomen. And again, seeing 1 or 2 shouldn't be of concern, but we've only documented it in about 7 or 8 counties. And so if people were to get it, it's worth sending an email to PJ just so we can kind of keep track if we're getting records in new areas, which I suspect before the fall's over, we would definitely will have some.
And we did have a Facebook question. I think you mentioned cluster flies, but Lynn says her friend lives on Chambers Island in Green Bay and is having a problem with cluster/blowflies.
Okay, so blowflies typically are associated with dead animals. And so if you had a squirrel die in the attic, you get this explosion. Typically, they're often metallic looking, greens and blues. Cluster flies look just like a house fly, and if you were to get one under a microscope, you see this very fine golden hairs, almost like it reminds me of corn silk, which is the way we identify these creatures. Cluster flies are just a fall invading insect. They start this game as early as the 1st of September, and then once they get in the siding in the attic, you pay for it all winter long, because when things warm up, some wake up. And so now's the time you have to draw the line in the sand, and either you seal things up so they can't get in, particularly high soffits and overhangs because they crawl upwards and squeeze into things there, or if it's just impossible to squeeze things out, you can spray the outside of the house. You kill them before they get in. Once they get in the walls, to be honest, it really isn't worth spraying anything because you really can't penetrate the walls to kill them.
Terry in North Lake has a question for you, so let's go there. Terry, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. Well, I have brought a bug in my house in the form of a caterpillar, swallowtail caterpillar, which is now, I think the correct term would be chrysalis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm expecting it to emerge in probably about a week. And now I've noted that there are no longer any butterflies around.
Right.
I'm wondering if there's anything that I can do once it's emerged to help it, because it's going to be so much cooler than it was.
So I honestly think you would be doing it a favor by putting it in a more outdoorsy type setting. I have a feeling it's already conditioned not to emerge. Insects use day length like plants do. And so swallowtails overwinter as the chrysalis stage. And typically,
well, they do.
Yeah, so this would typically be found in leaf litter and the like. And it would be doing it a disservice by leaving it indoors because the warmer conditions would just get it all
goofed
up. And among other things, it will burn way more energy than if it's in a cooler situation. So I think, you know, putting it in a coffee can or some protected environment, taking it out in the garage if it's unheated would be fine. Putting it out in a porch, let it go through the normal chilling process, the warming up in the spring, and then it'll emerge about on time with the regular swallowtails. But yeah, that's their strategy, is to get through as chrysalises and then emerge next spring.
Because I read about them online. Of course, it was a black swallowtail that I read about that said 1 to 2 weeks.
Yeah, and if it was the summer, that's what would be expected. But as I said, I have a strong feeling.
Okay, I understand that now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Terry.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, and kind of a related question from Mike in Castle Rock. Says, I have a monarch chrysalis in my yard, and I wanted to know whether it would overwinter.
I don't think so. Again, their strategy is to migrate and then come up. And so a lot of times insects don't have the choice. It's interesting, if you have an extended growing season, insects will try to take advantage of it and have extra generations or partial generations. Sometimes that works for them, sometimes not. But in the case of monarchs, they really are not conditioned to spend the winter. It wouldn't have the energy reserves to do it. So the best hope is it emerges relatively quickly and still things will be warm enough and it has a chance to migrate. But it's getting towards the end. It's getting, you know, and it depends a lot on how the fall progresses, I think, is where, if it will be successful or not.
Joe in Wausau has a question. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I have a little tiny black beetle that seems to be attracted to fluorescent lights. They're about 1/16 of an inch long. They seem to be able to fly, and I wondered what was attracting them and how I could get rid of them, if that's possible.
Okay. Need some more info. I you know, I don't know if you can take a reasonable picture and send it either to me or to PJ, or send the samples down to PJ in the diagnostic lab. It could be a couple, three things. If we know what the critter is, I can point you to the source. There's a lot of insects that are attracted to light. So, you know, one of the thoughts, it could be something like a warehouse beetle that has been breeding in a bag of dog food you forgot about, and they're emerging from there. One of the other things we're seeing, moderately common, and it happens quite often in the fall, is there are fungus beetles from outside that sometimes are attracted in the house. But there's other possibilities, too. And so, as I said, if we knew exactly what the critter was, the problem with beetles is there are literally hundreds of ones that kind of fit that general description. So, as I said, we kind of need a little more of a handle to see who it is before we can point you in the right direction. But the bottom line, it's not normal. I mean, you got critters like that, there's something going on here. And as I said, if we knew what the critter was, then we could probably figure out the source and get it solved pretty quickly.
So if you have some, or if you get a good close-up picture, or maybe you could post that up on our Facebook page, we could take a look at it. If not, grab some samples and mail them.
Yeah, okay. The Insect Diagnostic Lab is 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive. Madison, the university zip is 53706. Or if you're close to the local extension office, sometimes the agents can identify it right there, or people in the office can take pictures and send those down or send the samples. So you've got either option, really.
Yep, there we go. Good luck, Joe.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And you can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We have open lines for you. Let's turn to Brian in Fitchburg next. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been trying not to call your show for weeks. I went to the Extension website and posted a photo weeks ago, and it was suggested that it was possibly a drain flies that we were having problems with in our bathroom. And they're about 1/4 inch long, little black, I guess they're a fly, but they don't really grow up to fly yet. But we just, you know, quick crunch them with our thumb and they go away. But, you know, I think they're drain flies, and sure, I've been trying to get rid of them. And oftentimes Phil's advice seems to be, oh, you know, they'll go away in a certain season period, and they haven't. So
So the problem with drain flies is they're breeding on the kind of organic gook that you often associate with drains that don't get a lot of water through them. So floor drains in the basement are notorious. Now, so we have to have moisture and we have to have organic matter. So a couple, three thoughts for the bathroom. If the grout is going out on the tiles, sometimes you get enough water and stuff washed back in there that that's the breeding site. Okay. Sometimes it is the overflow in the sink in the bathroom that, again, gets an accumulation of organic matter, stays moist, and that's where the maggots are living. And then when they finally transform, you see the adults. And so you can flush this. Now, a mistake I see people make a lot is they get a little bleach water and throw it down, and that doesn't do anything. Now, some cases, you know, using some kind of plunger so that you can loosen that stuff. I know we've had problems in our shower drain. It gets an accumulation of hair and debris, and then it gets kind of gooky, and they seem to like that. So literally I have to, you know, take the drain cap off and clean all that goop out. If you're going to use something that has to eat through it, I would suggest more of a bacterial digesting type product rather than a caustic thing like Drano, because what will happen is the enzymes in the bacteria will break down that organic matter so that you can flush water through. Sometimes I've had at least moderate luck with a real hot pail of water down a drain. What you might consider, you know, one evening when you go to bed is taking a little piece of, especially if you're seeing a couple, three a day or more than that, a little piece of Saran wrap or whatnot and putting it over the drains and openings and just see if you flush any, you know, if they kind of get caught on the other side. So in the morning you wake up and see them kind of smiling at you through the Saran wrap. You can identify the site.
And then we'd know where they're coming from. Right. That's another mystery, too, by the...
Right. One, in the bathroom, there's so many places, and as I said, it's got to be the combination of moisture and organic matter. Basement floor drains are notorious only because we don't wash that much water through them, and they sometimes get this accumulation, but I wouldn't expect it to be the source in the basement if they're all showing up in the bathroom. It's got to be somewhere there.
You wouldn't think that it's possibly a fan that you know you have in a bathroom that vents out to the soffit?
No. You would have to have had a major water issue to have enough organic matter and moisture for them to breed there. And as I said, you could see if you were getting a lot of water seeping underneath tile that sometimes you get an accumulation of this kind of stuff. Notorious, it's a floor drain problem. You see this in manufacturing facilities all the time. They have major issues. In fact, that's why a lot of them periodically, once every month or so, we'll put organic-type products through the drain to allow it to get clean and flushed.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Thank you for calling. Just to take a look at Facebook, we have some shots on Facebook here. Claudia sent one, said this fellow was 1.5 inches long, had an orange projection that seemed to be separate from his proboscis. I saw him in Northeast Illinois.
Yeah, so I'm taking a little bit of a stab here because I can't see as much of this as I want, but I think this is the giant black horsefly. And the projection is its antennae. And, you know, most horseflies are much smaller, and this thing is actually huge. It doesn't bother people, but boy, it really bothers horses to the point that they will literally run through fences and other things sometimes to get away from them. So I think that's what it is the black horsefly is the official name, but I think giant black horsefly fits a little bit more.
And Owen sent a shot of a hungry hopper spider checking out a pearl crescent spot butterfly near Siskiwit Lake in Cornucopia area. Pretty cool.
I can see. At first I had to take a double take to see the spider eyes, and then I could figure out what was going on here. And great picture. That is a great
photo. And then Carl sent us an update. His dad released 104 monarchs this season. Next year he will tag them. He sent a photo.
You know, this is the second year. I mean, last year I had said, you know, with my first year of retirement, I got out to maybe do a little bit more walking during the day than I could before. And I thought the monarch numbers were up. That's the way it felt to me all summer long. I think I saw more monarchs. We haven't been overrun, but it's been pretty constant when I've been outdoors and whatnot. So it will be interesting. You know, we're probably a good 2 months away from getting a good assessment of what's going on in Mexico, but at least I'm cautiously optimistic that we can continue to start build back from this you know, precipitous drop of the last 10 years.
Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are taking a look at insects right now with Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, a retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always great to have him along.
and a couple of open lines. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a photo you want to share, or at least you have a question about an insect you have a photo of, put it up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We say, always love to hear see those as well. Or if you just got a cool insect photo, I like to see those too. Chris in Columbus has a question for you, Phil, so let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi, great show as usual. And I got a follow-up question from a previous show.
Okay.
Had Japanese beetles for the first time and controlled them with grub control, or are going to try to, applied it around the rose bushes and in other areas of the lawn and flower beds. But they also really liked my eggplant and other garden vegetables. But the warning label on the product, grub control product, contained imidacloprid.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it says on there to not use or not eat fruit or vegetables from treated areas for a full year after application.
Okay,
so I'm wondering, what can I control with then instead of that? And do I really got to wait a full year?
Well, there's two things going on. My first recommendation is don't bother with grub control, because your biggest headache is beetles that are flying in from off your property. And you've got no control of that. And so if your lawn was so decimated with grubs that it was dying, then I'd say then it's worth it. The other interesting thing is that you could buy that same insecticide under a different label that was made for putting on vegetables and raspberries, and it would allow you, with certain limitations, 14 days, 21 days, and the like. But, you know, legally, the label defines how the product can be used. And what I'm guessing is that the product you had was basically for ornamentals and not for vegetables, whereas the vegetable product, as I said, is just for vegetables and not ornamentals. And what's frustrating, it's the same product. So if you want to get some guidance, I think if you go to the product label for vegetables, it will give you a definition of the crops it can be used on and how long you wait. One of the things about that product is it does not translocate into fruit near as efficiently as it does into foliar parts. And that's why they get away with having labels on fruits and vegetables to one degree or another. But again, going back to your frustration, that I was almost going to say when you first said they first started showing up this year, I'm sorry, because my experience with Japanese beetles is it's often a 5 to 7 year buildup, and they're going to get worse and worse and worse. But I have had them in the area, my area, the west side of Madison now for going on 17 years, and they're almost non-existent. It's interesting. It's like kind of a peak and valley, and we're definitely in the valley. And where mine migrate from is the golf course that is about a block and a half from my home. And that's the problem. We see them flying in from a mile or more. So I hate to see people go through any kind of soil treatments in particular. Now, the one difference, if you took that same product that you talked about and they were eating your birch tree, and you applied it according to label directions to the roots of the birch tree and the plant moved the chemical up, it would protect the leaves of the birch. So that kind of systemic is very efficient for treating plants, but it is not, as I said, one of the other things we talk about at times, there's an organic bacterial product for killing grubs. It's a great product if grubs are indeed your problem. But as I said, I would guess that if you were to pull back the turf that you've got now, if you saw one or two grubs per square foot, you'd be having much higher numbers than I expect. And in order to damage turf, we're starting talking 30, 35 grubs per square foot.
And
stuff. So as I said, I don't think it's as bad as you think. Consult the vegetable label to give you a little bit more guidance on the imidacloprid. But in the future, as I said, save it for some other uses and don't bother trying to control Japanese beetle grubs with it.
There we go. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the call. Karen in Black Creek, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, we just recently moved to about 40 acres of land outside of Black Creek. There's about an 80-acre pond on the property and some lowland. This has been property that's been in the family for a while, but we just purchased it. There are
flocks of mosquitoes. I mean, you can hardly stand to be out in the woods at all because of the mosquitoes. Now, I've heard some private companies, you know, advertise that they can help with mosquito control short of bringing in a ton of bats. Is there anything that a private homeowner can do to try to control mosquitoes? My brother-in-law lives in Minnesota in a place with a similar landscape, and their village actually does some kind of mosquito control thing. So I was just wondering what a private homeowner could do.
Well, what complicates the story is the pond may or may not be a source. And if the pond is a source, there are some things that can be done. But that's always the problem, is that we find that probably 90% of the mosquitoes come from about 10% of the available water. And so you almost have to do your homework. My guess is, you know, the way we go out and sample for them is just with a little plastic dip cup, and we're looking for the larvae in the summer. Now, if you've got fish and frogs and other things in the pond, it's not that likely. In fact, what typically gets us in the biggest problem in Wisconsin and Minnesota is fluctuating water, where it floods and dries out and floods and dries out. If that water holds for a couple weeks, the mosquitoes can take advantage, breed, and you really don't get time to get a balance or predators in there. They're already out of there. And so if indeed the pond was the source, there are some bacterial insecticides that can be applied that are very selective and will kill the larvae. One of the other strategies, and it's going after a whole different area, and honestly, it's more of a temporary fix at best, is there are chemicals you can spray all around your yard, and if the critters land there, they will die anytime in the next couple of weeks. And the way I explain my personal philosophy is, if you're going to have a family wedding and you wanted to do this before the wedding so everybody could be comfortable, I think that's a great strategy. But if you're using this as your main strategy for controlling mosquitoes and you have to apply the product four or five times a year, you really mess up the environment. It's not a recommended thing. So, you know, yes, there are things that can be done, but that kind of strategy in the long run, I think, is taking you the wrong direction. So the bottom line, it's going to take a little bit of homework to see if indeed they are breeding on your property, and then if it is, what are my options? So I'm sorry it's not a simple question.
Yeah.
But with 54 different kinds of mosquitoes, there's a whole bunch of different scenarios that play out, unfortunately.
Well, I didn't know that there were 54 different kinds of mosquitoes, so that's at least I learned something. Is there, if you know, you were describing the land that floods and then dries up. That is exactly the situation just behind the house, not by the pond. So is there some research that I could do to try to figure out, I mean, if that's where they're coming from, I can determine what the larvae are and reach out to somebody maybe at the extension or something?
Sure. In fact, what we'd have is times people would collect the larvae and send them, and we can identify them from there. As I said, you know, it's like some mosquitoes only go through one generation. They're a spring problem. Other ones go through multiple generations, and all these variables are important pieces of information for deciding, you know, what's going on. One of the other options, potentially, is if there is fluctuating water, is if there are some land use changes that can keep the water more permanent, you know, and stable. It honestly, is a method that is sometimes used to manipulate the environment so that it's less favorable for mosquitoes. But unfortunately, in Wisconsin, we don't have the big abatement districts. In some other states, there are professional biologists that go out and they map all the water. They know where the problem sites are. They know where it's going to be. And in many cases, these are multi-county type programs, and they take care of it as part of their normal operations. But we traditionally have not had enough human disease in this state to justify those kinds of strategies. And so we just have never organized at that level in Wisconsin.
Okay. Could you suggest any resources that I might be able to reach out to locally? Would it be the extension? Is that the right place to try to contact?
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, you can try, in some cases, local public health officials will do some things because they do get involved in some cases in mosquito issues. You know, there's a very good program up in La Crosse. I mean, they literally run a county program. It's not targeted for all mosquitoes. They're trying to deal with some of the more disease vectors for, like, La Crosse encephalitis. But there is, as I said, I think with a little hunting, you might be able to get some people. But the bottom line is, you know, people are going to have to sample this in the summer when things are ongoing to really be able to give you the kind of solid answers that you need.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it, Karen. Thanks for calling. And Bob in Eau Claire.
Good morning, guys.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
You betcha. Hey, we have got an interesting cluster of bee beetle-like insects. They are about an inch to an inch and a half long, and they have real long antennae, and they kind of come out of their heads in almost like arching eyebrows. And they are living on the heads of our milkweed pods.
Ah.
That's the only place that I've seen them. I have taken pictures. Unfortunately, I'm on the road right now.
Sure.
So I can't send you the picture.
But we know what it is. So at first, okay. I was thinking box elder bug, and the minute you said milkweed, I changed my direction. There is a creature that feeds on the seed of milkweed, and we call it the milkweed seed bug. In fact, there's two species you can run into in the Midwest, and they're just doing what comes natural. They feed on the seeds. Really, you know, they affect the viability of the seed to some degree, but not to the point that we worry about them as a pest. They congregate in the fall. They will not come in the house like box elder bugs, so they find their own places to hide out and then start everything again in the spring. So it's an interesting one. It's an insect that, as a graduate student, we used to work with this for doing experiments, and I just never saw them around Wisconsin very commonly, but in the last 10 years, they've taken off, which is another one of these creatures that I kind of wonder that the changing lack of cold winter is allowing it to become better established, because, as I said, milkweed seed bug was more a curiosity 40 years ago for me, and now it's quite common. I have the same thing on my butterfly weed every year.
And they look like box elder bugs.
Yeah, just a little more orange.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
A little, right, yep.
And I've got them on my milkweed.
Yep. And so they're having a pretty good year.
Yeah, it's been a great year for them.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Yeah, I looking at a couple last night, as a matter of fact, on my milkweed. Mary in Marshfield. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I'm so glad you have Bill on today, because we are facing, you know, the emerald ash borer is coming into our part of the state. And we have a huge green ash that goes up through our deck. And I had the arborist here last week to give me an estimate on how much the shots would be. Well, they're $500 a year every 2 years, because this tree has a circumference of 120-some inches.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big tree. It's, you know, it's higher than the house. It's huge. And it comes right up through our deck. We built the deck around it. So it's a pretty important tree. But my husband was looking at the internet, and they ortho has a drench.
Mm-hmm.
And that is cheaper. Because, I mean, you're looking at that. He said it's $500, but that's every 2 years for infinity.
Yeah. Sure. Well, the ortho drench, I guess my comment is that, in general, there's a feeling that very large trees are getting underdosed with that treatment if you follow label directions.
Okay.
The label doesn't allow you to use as much as we think may need to be to protect the tree. So if it's a small tree, I would think it would be a great alternative. But for a large tree, unfortunately, the cost, although, you know, as you know, that's a very valuable tree worth thousands of dollars, aside from the problem of getting out, just the aesthetics, the property value. So it may be worth it. I mean, you can talk to other arborists. My feeling is you might find it a little less expensive, but not all that much. And again, the biggest problem is the size of the tree.
And you look at it this way, okay, that's about $20 a month. Yeah. That's about what you're going to be.
And the tree is so close to the house, it would have to be taken down limb by limb. So if we ever have to take it down, it's going to be thousands and thousands of dollars.
Somewhere between $3,000 and $5,000, probably.
Yeah. No. So I think when you weigh it all through, the one thing is this is building in communities. It's not something that has to be done tomorrow type of thing. But definitely, I think, you know, if you're serious about being a valuable tree, as this starts to build up in your area, you got to get in there and protect it.
Yeah.
Well, could you do the branch and then just do it twice a year?
The problem is,
so this is how crazy the world is. So the label allows you to do it once a year, but because of the way they run the calendar, you can do a fall treatment And you can do a spring treatment, and you are not doing it. You're doing it in separate years.
Right.
But for the next year, then, you're pretty well shot. You can't put another fall application on. And as I said, the bottom line is, other than the Bayer product, there are other labels that allow people to use somewhat more chemical, but these are commercial labels. They're harder products to find. And so you're, again, kind of caught in a situation. You can talk to the arborist and see what his costs would be for putting the liquid drench instead of I would assume that he's going to use Triage as his injectable product because he's saying he's getting 2 years treatment out of it. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what he said. And he said, you know, part of the reason it's going to be so high is that they have to put so many shots in for a tree of 120 inches around.
Yeah, I would guess if your husband looks at the label rates and figures it out, you know, a tree that much is still going to be hundreds of dollars of drench product. You know, it isn't a cheap treatment, unfortunately. But as I said, you can consult with the arborist and ask if you did a drench what his charge would be. But I would probably lean toward the Triage treatment again because you're getting 2 years out of it. It sounds like, you know, how you put this product on, because you'd have to pour it on the root zone. It's close to the house. I mean, there seems to be maybe some complications there.
Yeah. And it's, like I said, it's one of those things. Okay, well, we have monthly bills, and this one is going to be figure out about $21 a month for the rest of the tree's life to keep it going. And
yeah.
That's about all you can say. You know, there comes a point where, you know, it's part of the house, in a way. It's part of the deck. I know you're angst, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you, guys. I appreciate the help.
Yeah. I'd go with a $500 treatment. It was me. And Terry in Upper Peninsula.
Larry, great show. I love your show, man.
Thank you.
I've been meaning to ask your bug guy this question for many years. This time of year, I get thousands, literally thousands of flies coming out of the woodwork.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get out. They're not trying to get in the house. I have to open all my screens to let them out this time of year. And I'm just wondering what their life cycle is. Are they living in the walls and they come out this time of year? Do they going to breed now? They come back in?
Yeah. So this is an annual problem. You can predict it every fall. Okay. It's got to be.
Everybody up here has them.
Yeah. It's got to be cluster flies. So,
is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
So cluster flies are parasites of earthworms in the summer.
Huh.
So they lay their eggs, the maggots find earthworms. And so you see a bit of a fluctuation in very dry years. When it's a bad worm year, there's less cluster flies.
Huh.
But then, up your way, usually about the last week of August, the flies that are out there start looking for shelter. And they're particularly, it's a visual thing. So if you've got a nice exposure on a cabin or a house, it's like a magnet. You put that same house in the middle of the woods where the sun never gets to it, and those people don't know what you're talking about when you complain about the flies. Now, typically, they will crawl and stay in those voids in the walls. But for some reason, they're staying active. And it may just be, you know, they find a shelter, but then you get a nice warm day, and all of a sudden they're waking up and say, hey, let's go out and check out, you know,
what's
going on.
Yeah, anytime it's warm, and I started a wood fire last night because of the frost, and I have 1,000 today.
yes. So.
Now, I have to let them out. They want out. They're not coming into the house.
Well, but they're
out
in
the wall.
Yeah, somehow.
They're in the wall, somehow.
You know, and as you warm it up, as I said, and this is what happens all winter long. I mean, they get reactivated, and you find most of them die within a day or two. You know, it's a poor decision on their part, because insects being cold-blooded, if it stayed cold, they're not burning much energy. But if you warm them up, wake them up, it's kind of like they burn all the gas in the gas tank and they die.
Yeah. Now, are these in the spring? I have thousands of flies on the outside on all my siding. Is that the same fly?
Same fly, yep.
And they're coming in then.
Well, no, I think it's
I don't know.
You've got it somewhat reversed to the normal in that typically in the fall, they're all coming into the structure, and in the spring, they're all trying to get out.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Cool photo on our Facebook page from Sue, who says, here's a grasshopper looking at me as I am looking at he. love that. A very nice close-up from the underside, and look at the face on that thing.
Yes. And, you know, we have, I'm guessing off the top of my head, probably about 60 different species of grasshoppers in the state. You know, and
so
many insects, they're far more diverse than people usually think about. And so, lots of neat variations. I can tell it's a shorthorn grasshopper because of the short antennae, but that's about the best I can do with it.
All right. There we go. We have Kathy in Presque Isle next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Say, you answered most of my questions. I had a question on cluster flies as well.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, is there anything that can be done to prevent them from coming in? I know there are loom fumigators that different companies put out, something like that. Is there anything that would prevent them? Because like the other caller, we're just inundated with the flies this year. I mean, we've always had them, but this year their numbers are extremely high.
Yeah. Indoors, nothing is worth the effort. In fact, it's a waste of time setting off bombs and the like. I mean, you kill flies, but you only kill the ones that are in your space, and you can't kill the ones in the wall. So, you know, it's one of two things, is to really be meticulous and caulk and seal. And again, if I had to err, it would be on the south and west sides of the house, and it would be high. Because what you see in the cool mornings is the cluster flies are on the outside of the walls, and when the sun hits them, they kind of wake up and they crawl upward. So that's what allows mm-hmm. them to work underneath siding, work up into soffits. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we find that people, they have roof vents, but they're not screened. And so it's mm-hmm. like a big hole in the wall, and they all come pouring in. Now they're in the attic, and they filter down through your light fixtures and like. So the best strategy is the physical solving of the riddle of how they get in. Now, in old cabins and stuff, people say it's just impossible. So then there are sprays, whether you buy them or you get a commercial company to come. And ideally, they should have went on 2 weeks ago because we're already into mm-hmm. the season. But the mm-hmm. sprays will both repel and kill them. And they're basically using various pyrethroid sprays. These are the kind of barn sprays that are used in dairy barns. As I said, it's all about timing. If you were to call somebody on the 1st of November and say, come spray, I'd tell you you're wasting your money because mm-hmm. they're already in the walls. We can't stop them. But knowing that this 3 or 4 week period of time when it's starting to cool down and we're getting those nice warm days, that's the trigger that seems to get them coming in. And as I said, you can pretty well figure your sunny parts of the house are where the problems are coming in.
Sure, yeah.
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at insects today with Phil Pelletieri, our resident entomologist. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for joining us. If you have a question and you want to talk to Phil, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you've got a photo that you want to share or have a question about a particular insect, or maybe you just have a nice insect photo. Post it up on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the Facebook page title. Post it there. Otherwise, you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. John in Mason has a question or a comment, so let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that I like box elder beetles. I think they're really cool. They seem to move out of your way when you're walking towards them, and they don't seem to hurt anything or be harmful to anything, maybe box elders, but they're a weed tree anyway. But that's my comment. My question is, does Phil know anything about the Asian hornet, and is it made its way to our country yet?
Is this the giant one you're talking about?
The giant Asian hornet?
Yeah.
Yeah. It has not, to my recollection. I haven't seen any postings. I know it's caught people's attention because it is so big and mean looking and the like.
Well,
and
it's downright evil.
yeah. And but no, it has not that we're aware of. You always have to have that caveat, but no.
Yeah. All righty. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And box elder bugs?
Yeah. It's the nuisance factor. And people just don't like things showing up in the morning on your breakfast table in the winter. I'm just guessing it's been wet enough this year. They generally don't do well in wet weather because they all get sick from a fungus disease. So it's not going to be a banner year for box elder bugs. But unfortunately, if you're in the wrong place and, you can see them. And again, this is the time to draw the line in the sand. This is when they're starting to try to sneak in. And, you know, as we talked about, new construction tends with some of the house wraps and whatnot tends to be more bug proof. I wish people would think about that more when they're building houses of how important it is to seal various things up, not just for energy reasons, but think again, my insects and mice also can kind of weasel back and forth. And so if you're good at sealing those entrance points up early, boy, you save yourself a whole lot of headaches down the road.
We have Lori in Green Bay next with a question. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I have this beautiful snake root plant that I've had for about 4 or 5 years, and it blossoms at this time of year. Beautiful. All the bumblebees just love it. But I've noticed in the past there are these little beetles about maybe 1/4 inch long. They're not very wide, maybe 1/8, if even that. And this year they're just all over the plant on the flower part. I was just wondering if those are something I have to worry about. I mean, there's nothing I would spray it with that's toxic because it'd hurt the bumblebees too, mm-hmm. but just wondering if it's a problem.
Yeah, I don't think so. Just from your description, I think what they're trying to do is steal pollen and stuff. So there's a bit of a competition thing with the bees, but to the health of the plant, it's not a problem, so I wouldn't worry.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thanks a lot for calling. Gary in Madison, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Yes, okay. Every year, I have a cedar house. Every year, it seems like bees come, and then they start entering into the side of the house. And this year, I was inside. I heard like this, sounded like, I thought it was a chipmunk that was eating a peanut or something. But I went outside, and turns out that that's where the bees were. Coming in. So I tried to seal off all kinds of different areas with all kinds of things, and I mean, they always find the next little slot to get in. So, what do I do? And what happens to them after the winter? I mean, I've never had a problem like all of a sudden it turns to be the spring and now I've got a big bee problem.
Sure.
What goes on here? What do I need to do?
Okay, so they're probably not bees. They're probably wasps. And the way all our wasps work is, although they can build nests, paper wasp nests, in the wall voids and other spaces they're finding, in the fall of the year, they basically die out. And it's really more of a starvation. But they do produce new queens that have been fertilized in the fall, and they go crawl under a rock somewhere, spend the winter, and then in the spring, they have to find a new place to start from scratch. And if there's enough openings and cracks in the cedar, then they find a new home. So the good news is that in a matter of time, it will run its course. You're doing what I would suggest is you try as best as possible to seal things up. And at this time of year when somebody calls and says, I see them coming and going in the wall, what should I do? The worst thing you can do is seal it up before you treat it, because that I've literally seen them eat through wallboard to find a way out. And then they're very angry and coming at you from every which direction.
You don't want to do that.
Yeah. So, if it's a place that there's a lot of people traffic and you have a concern, what I find for non-exposed nests is to use a dust. And sometimes you have to use a device to help blow the dust in that entrance. But the dust tend to perform much better than sprays for nests that I cannot see. Again, if it's in the back of the house, it's not bothering anybody. You've already went to the end of September. Nobody's getting stung. Let them be. Next spring, seal that opening up. There's not going to be a problem with it. The other option, if this just is driving you, every year it's a big frustration, because the new nests are being founded in the spring, it would be reasonable to consider to spray the outside of the walls, and in particular, make sure that the spray is directed up into those openings and cracks. With the same kind of products we're using to stop the box elder bugs and Asian lady beetles now. They're pyrethroids, and what you're doing is you're killing the queens when they're starting this, the whole mess. And that really is much more effective than waiting till the fire kind of gets out of control in the end of the summer and we're dealing with hundreds, if not thousands, of critters rather than just a queen.
Hmm. What would the noise have been? What was the noise that I was hearing?
It wouldn't surprise me if they're finding something that's a little bit soft, they were chewing into it. I have seen them chew into, they're expanding the nest or the void. They're, by themselves, they're not good diggers. So, you know, when you find one in the ground, they didn't dig the hole. It was an old gopher burrow or a washed out area under a slab, and they found that void and started the nest. But they will try to excavate it, make it a little bigger. The same with a void space in a wall is, you know, they might be trying to move insulation or other things, trying to expand it as best as possible. Although I will tell you that their populations have been in decline, I'm sure, for the last couple, 3 weeks. They kind of peak in early September and then seem to start to take a nosedive.
Yeah, well, I got stung by one of them. That must be a wasp. I'll tell you what, that still have a mark on my hand from that.
Yeah, no, it's quite common to get, very painful for a number of hours, and then it kind of transforms into this very itchy lump that often takes a whole lot of time to settle down, and that's classic. And unlike honeybees, which is the only bee that leaves a stinger behind, these wasps, you know, it is a needle, and every time they are sticking it into you, they're trying to inject venom, and a lot of the effect you get is a result of how much venom got into your system.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I can imagine what it would be like getting stung by more than one. My goodness.
Yeah, and that's why we have the tragedies at this time of the year when people are out mowing and stuff and they didn't know there's a nest, and they drive over it and the like. And you never hear about those complaints in June because there's just no numbers. It's, again, it's always a late summer, early fall kind of story.
Yeah, it happened to me in September of several years back, and I was stung several times in the face. I was really scared. I really kind of worried because I was at home alone.
Yeah, no, and we definitely have every year cases in the emergency room of these kind of tragedies where people get multiple stings and bodies react and very severely, and it can be life-threatening.
Thanks again, Gary, for calling. Appreciate it. And Darlene in Mayville, before we get to you, there's a sort of a related from Jody on Facebook wondering if yellow jackets overwinter. Do they overwinter?
It's the same story as fertilized queens. That's the only thing that can spend the winter.
Now to Darlene in Mayville. Thank you for waiting. Hi, Darlene.
No problem. Hi. A few years back, I noticed I had millipedes in my lower level that I had finished up. There was a crack in part of the basement that was my furnace room. I plugged that whole crack up. I didn't notice any for a couple of years. Now, this year, I'm finding a few upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
Where the devil do they come from, and how do I get rid of them?
Good news is they're not breeding inside. Good news is they don't hurt anything other than contaminate the house.
Yeah.
But the frustration with millipedes, they're a critter that lives in the soil feeding on organic matter.
Okay.
And at certain times of the year, you get a migration. And it's more typically the fall. So it's not your lawn. It probably is a beautiful prairie or CRP field or someplace that there's a lot of organic matter. And it can be 200 yards away. So at night, they get out cruising around, and then when the sun comes up, they try to collect where it's cool and damp. Mm-hmm. And that's what, at times, they're coming in the house, which is a big mistake. You notice that they die very shortly because it's too dry, nothing to eat. So one of the places to look for a problem is where your foundation meets the siding.
Okay.
Also, if you've got any vents or anything else that breach the wall that may have a crack that they can crawl into, anything you can do to seal that up will help, at least keeping them outdoors. The people that I really have a hard time giving an answer to that they like to hear is if they're talking about, every day I go out and I sweep up a bucket full on my garage slab. Well, they're migrating in from areas away. It doesn't do any good to spray the garage slab because that's not where they're coming from. And, other than sweeping them up, you just kind of have to kind of wait until things settle down. And it sometimes is a 3 or 4 week process. And at times, it's like a science fiction movie. The sheer number of insects that people will send me pictures of, they're 3 inches deep along the siding, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And as I said, I always know the source is off at least the manicured part of the property, and it has to be this source of organic matter in the soil that was breeding them. And we think, maybe they're looking for greener pastures, that the populations are so high where they are, they're looking to migrate to some place that is better, and that's what's bringing them into the house, unfortunately.
Is it a possibility that my dog could be bringing some in?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I really don't.
I don't pick up after her, but every 3-4 days, would that be a...
No.
No,
I said, it's just purely they're looking for a place that's cool and damp, and that whether they come under a door sweep or a crack in the foundation, or as I said, most homes, the weakness is where the siding meets the foundation.
Okay.
Things can crawl up in through there and then end up in all kinds of places in the house.
Okay, so just spray around the foundation. That should help a little bit, huh?
Well, slow them up. But you know what I always tell people is if you know it's the north side of your property, sometimes it's better to treat where you stop mowing and where this long grass starts to put the barrier out there so that they die before they get to the house. One of the problems with spraying along the foundation is they can crawl through the spray, still make it in the house, and then they die, and you still got to sweep them up.
There you go. Thanks, Darlene. Kathleen in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a kind of a fun little story of something my daughter and I do. We've got a couple of oak trees that we like to go gather the acorns from, and almost all of the acorns, at least the first part of the season, are infested with acorn weevil grubs. And so there's a little acorn weevil that hatches out of the ground, lays their eggs in the acorns, and at this time of year, when we bring those acorns inside, we put them on a drying rack, and it kind of just rains grubs for a couple of days. And so we'll be collecting like 70 to 100 of these little white grubs. And the purpose of that is that we take them over to the Four Lakes Wildlife Center, and they feed them to the birds that they've rescued, and it's just like bird kibble.
That is a great way of making use of them, and I'm sure they very much appreciate the help.
Yeah, and we have to take a quick look at the news. We'll talk about that later. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, talking the world of insects today with entomologist Phil Pelletieri, and certainly inviting you to join in. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you want to post an insect photo or have a question, you can also post it on our Facebook page, the title of which is The Larry Mueller Show. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. And lots of callers online, Phil. And so I think we'll go right straight to Karen in Rosholt. Karen, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am wondering about hedge balls. I see them in the produce department, and they say they're supposed to stave off spiders. Do they work?
Just a teeny bit. So what it is if you extract the chemicals in there and expose the spiders to it, there is a repellency there. So there's a little bit of truth. But an intact hedge ball sitting in the corner of your kitchen isn't going to do you any good.
Oh, because that's what I've been doing, and I still see spiders in the winter.
Yeah. No,
so,
they said it's
cut it or break it? Or?
Well, you know, because the liquid that there is, if I remember right, kind of staining, I just don't think it's practical. The experiments were done. There are chemicals within there that do have some repellency, but not intact. And I've never seen anybody extract them into a spray, which would make the most sense. And again, I wonder it's because there's some staining properties or other concerns with that.
Yes, yes. Oh, okay. Well, I just wanted to clarify that because I was using it whole and wasn't seeing the results. So.
Yeah, and you're not going to, probably, unfortunately. Thanks, Karen, for calling. Appreciate it. Alex and Nina has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Alex.
Hey there. I keep isopods, so sow bugs, pill bugs, in a terrarium to clean up after my terrarium pets. What's the best way to make the terrarium more habitable for them and to make them like it and want to move in?
Boy, aside from keeping things a little bit moist and giving them a good source of organic matter, so, you know, leaf litter, that kind of stuff, I would think that should be more than sufficient to keep them happy.
Okay, fantastic.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Karen in Whitewater, hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks. I was on my deck earlier this summer, and I couldn't help but notice a dozen or so star or rather asterisk formations made by many small reddish-brown ants. And I thought this was really interesting, and I tried looking up this behavior online, couldn't find anything. Would Phil be able to explain this?
Not sure. Did they have wings or not?
No, they were ants. And they had other friends that were, like, joining them and in line, sort of behind each other, forming this asterisk formation. It's very interesting. And they seem to be sleeping or perhaps resting.
Yeah, no, I don't, you know, no. I was thinking if there's, you know, honeydew dripping from a tree or whatnot, it's kind of like a food trough, and they're all kind of hovering around that, but with as big a cluster, no. And earlier I was looking, you know, is it a bunch of males courting a female or whatnot, but they'd all have wings, and so, yeah, I'm kind of stumped on that one.
Okay, I took a picture and even a video. I'll send it to you. It's very interesting.
Oh, it'd be fun to see. Can you post it on our Facebook page?
I will. Unfortunately, I should have zoomed in closer. You'll have to look, or perhaps, you know, if Facebook has like a Zoom app. Yeah.
Sure.
But yeah, I'll be happy to post it.
All right. Thank you very much. I will. We'll look forward to that. Hopefully, you can get that posted soon, and we'll check it out for sure. Someone wondered if emerald ash borers affect red oaks, too.
No.
Nothing to worry about there.
The two-line chestnut borer is in the same genus. It's a native insect that is really our most significant insect pest on oaks. But they only attack trees that are stressed and weakened, drought stress, construction damage, and the like. And so, in a sense, they're like emerald ash borer in the way they function, their life cycles. But all the critters in that group are very host specific, so they stay on a very narrow range of trees. And unfortunately, the emerald ash borer, our ashes have no defenses, where at least with healthy oak trees, they have a defense against the chestnut borer.
Lance in Glendale, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. So on our property, we have a whole line of tree of heavens, and we have one really big one standing by itself. It had a very large branch going off, like almost parallel to the ground, and it came down. And we went to cut off the jagged edge. We discovered it was infested with carpenter ants, which is, I guess, why we lost the limb. And there was a large amount of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I sprayed them. I went back for many days, maybe almost a week, kept spraying till I didn't see any more ants. But they, of course, scattered. They went down the tree and up the tree. And I don't know if what I did was adequate or good or anything.
Sure. Two things. The tree, if it was healthy internally, would not have carpenter ants. So there was some kind of internal rot that created the cavity that they moved into.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't eat the wood, they just nest in weakened wood.
Right.
Now, it turns out that there may be unfertilized queens, but there was only one functional queen in that colony. So all the ants you saw running around were basically sterile females. So they're not going to cause a problem. The whole thing about controlling carpenter ants, if you need to, is you've got to kill the queen. And one would think that you probably had a pretty good opportunity because you knew where the nest was. You could get access to it, and that itself would have solved it. But I will make the argument as any property that's got more than a couple trees on it probably has carpenter ants. I mean, they are just ubiquitous. In fact, mm-hmm. we have a number of species in the state. And yeah, as I said, when you see the storm come through and a tree tips over and you see the ants in that hollow, discolored wood, people often sometimes make the wrong assumption that the ants, you know, caused the tree to fall, but it was the rot and the ants are moving in to that environment and the like. So
okay, so just getting in the cavity and spraying was all I could do anyhow.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Lance, for calling. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Judy and Racine, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. When we have spiders in the house, we don't kill them. We catch them and put them outside.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do that in the winter, can they find a place to survive?
It's going to be a challenge. It is possible, but being cold-blooded, you know, their metabolism just kind of shuts down. And what my fear is most of the time they can't move far enough to find a protected place to go. So
there's no good place to let them go in the winter?
Well, you know, part of what's interesting with insects and spiders is given the opportunity to adjust, they can often survive much better. So it's shock that kills them. So one would say, you know, fine, if you put them out in the garage where it's a little bit more protected and heated, but it's going to cool down, I would think they have a better chance of survival than if you just threw them right out on, you know, the back porch in the snow and whatnot, where they're really not going to shut down real quick. So there may be some adjustments you can make that give them a little bit more of a chance. And again, what I would say is anything you could do to gradually make the change, more so than the big shock, is going to be doing them a favor.
Okay, well, I do sometimes put them in the garage, so that's okay.
Yes, yes.
At least it's better.
Mm-hmm. It's better.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Judy. Annie in La Crosse. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I just checked my mail, and there are these weird bugs on my mailbox. It's in the sun, of course. They're 2 or 3 times the size of a ladybug, and they're kind of elongated, and they aren't, like, real shiny and smooth. They're kind of bumpy, and they're reddish-orange with black kind of stripes and dots. I just put a picture on your Facebook page, and I'm wondering, is this something new and invasive? Because I've never seen these before. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Okay. Thanks a lot for calling.
I'm glad you sent the picture, because my first thought was, are they box elder bugs? Because they kind of roughly, but the roughness of the body doesn't. So we'll just kind of see.
I don't know.
Those are immature box elder bugs, or what we call nymphs.
Oh.
And so they do look a little bit different. The wings aren't fully developed. To be honest, they're in some trouble because it's late enough in the season. They will not have an opportunity to mature, would be my guess, into adults, and only the adults seem to be successful in overwintering. So similar story to regular box elder bugs, definitely nothing to worry about, other than if you're growing box elder for seed, which I don't know if I've ever met anybody that has done that. So,
yeah, Ethan sent a note on Facebook saying, I heard something about tamarack bugs in northern Wisconsin. Are they real, and how damaging are they?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what I would call a tamarack bug. I know dead trees have some interesting critters in that could be called tamarack bugs, but those are pine sawyers and the like, would be my guess. Tamarack does have some case-bearing sawflies and whatnot that eat the foliage on it, but I don't know anything other than, again, that maybe defoliators of tamarack that I would consider to be of concern. So,
and we had some other comments. Edith has a very large ash tree they want to save, too. But how do you look for or research an arborist who has the training and experience, you know, to do the job, or probably any job for that matter?
Well, there's two parts to what goes on here. Now, anybody that's applying pesticides commercially has to be certified by the state. And I'll tell you that certification just means that they have the clearance and understanding of how to use the product and follow the label directions. When you talk about arborists that have shown competency, there is a national program that's a certification program. So they will advertise as certified arborists, which means they have passed an exam of competency in all areas of being an arborist. So that, I think, would be a measure. If somebody's a certified arborist nationally, the old-fashioned tree doctor, that's what I'd call them when I was a kid. But then on top of that, they will have a state certification that allows them to apply pesticides. So they really have two certifications. To me, the one that shows more professional competency is the national one.
Joanne, the mail carrier, wonders, why does the woolly bear cross the road?
So I will pass on. The first woolly bear seen in the Pelletieri household was by my wife, Tara, and it predicted a warm winter, so I was happy to see that. So all the woolly bears, whether it's the banded woolly bear, which is the one that traditionally is used for predicting the winter, or some of the other species, the yellow woolly bear and the leopard moth and the like, have this interesting strategy of crawling around in the fall and looking for a sheltered site. And they will not spin their cocoons and transform into moths until next spring. And they need a cold shock to get them there. So, but the weird thing is, you'd think if you found a nice, safe retreat, you'd stay there. But that's not the way they seem to work. And every time it warms up, they kind of wake up and start crawling around again, which to me seems pretty like a silly strategy, but it works for them. So you can expect to see woolly bears on these beautiful sunny days all the way until the temperature gets down to about 50 degrees. And then it starts to get cool enough that they really can't move much. But I've seen them in December. You get the right conditions, no snow on the ground, and you get a warm southern hillside, and be darned, they wake up again.
We have Jim in Hudson with a question next. Hi, Jim.
Well, I thought you were talking to me last time. Yeah, I have a question about the woolly bear thing that you just mentioned. I'm a hunter, and I'm out in the fall a lot. And to me, it seems like the woolly bears are almost always going across the road. You know, you don't see them going down the road or obliquely across the road, but it seems like they're going directly across the road.
Do you know, wow. I've never thought of it, but I agree with you. I don't think you don't see them wandering. They seem to have a focus, and I have no idea what they got going there. But that's an interesting observation.
Yeah, and I, you know, if I had more time and I was still being a science teacher, I'd probably go out and map all these things off and do the sun direction and everything, but it's just pretty anecdotal at this point.
Yeah,
well, it took me about 3 years to finally make this call.
Well, thanks a lot for calling.
Okay, but you seem to see them going across then, correct?
Yeah, the same thing. When I think about it, I rarely see them make the mistake of going up and down the road because they probably never find a place to go. Yeah. So they seem to be pretty good at finding the shortest route from one potential hiding, you know, overwinning place to the next.
Well, somebody out there that needs a research project to work on, there you go.
Right, thanks a lot. Yeah, appreciate the call. Rhoda sent a note. She says, we have a lot of these spiders coming into the house. I found this one in the dishwasher.
Okay. The animal's called the yellow sac spider, and they are the ones that often get up in the corners of your ceilings and make these little retreats. And then they are a hunting spider, and they crawl around looking for food. And so they show up in all kinds of places. So they're a relatively common indoor spider. I hate to add this to it. We don't get very many spider bites, true spider bites. A lot of times people get, you know, little bumps and they call it spiders and it's some other thing that's causing the thing. But I will tell you that sac spiders have been implicated on occasion. If they're mishandled, they will bite and sometimes cause a localized reaction. Not to the point I think I'd lose sleep on it, but just be a little careful around them and the like, as I said, because they do have the opportunity at times to cause a little bit of a skin reaction on people.
And let's see, we have John and Dane County next. Hi, John.
Hi, Phil. I recall seeing one time a temperature at which nighttime temperature late in the fall when insects simply cannot fly. They're immobile. And it seems to me that was a pretty critical temperature. Am I just imagining something, or?
No, it is. And hi, John. I recognize your voice. John's an old friend. So the figure that often is given is 50 degrees, but, you know, insects that are already starting to vibrate their muscles and whatnot generate enough heat. So you will see, and I see this when I'm out bow hunting sometimes on an evening that's, you know, 40 degrees. So it's 10 degrees. You see these little geometrid moths and other things flying around. So they're, in fact, they call them winter moths. A lot of those moths that are active at temperatures that seem to be below. But as I said, the partial trick that they're using, I think, is they're generating internally some of their own heat. And so they can be active at temperatures that normal insects aren't capable. And most of those things tend to have some pretty furry bodies or insulated bodies, so you can see where they could retain heat a little bit better than maybe some other critters.
But at 35 or...
Oh, no, yeah, they're in big trouble, John. There's just no way that, as I said, they can get the muscles moving at that.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. John and Jeff in Greendale, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello there. My brother and I plant, we have a lot of plants in my yard to purposely, attract bees. And, I notice, a couple hundred bumblebees on these plants throughout the yard. And toward evening, they become really docile and they just hang on the plant. Now, I've heard two things. I've heard they're drunk on pollen, and I've heard that they're heavy with pollen, and they'll fly back to their hive at some point when I don't see them. Which is it, or is it either one of those?
I just think they're resting, and interesting enough, insects sleep. All animals sleep. I really was, when we had a lecture in the department a couple years ago on a person who studies sleep and how important it is for all animals to kind of reprogram the brain, but I never had quite thought of it. In some cases, I see the same thing. Now, sometimes it's a cool night, you know, if the sun's going down, I think they somewhat lose their orientation. So I think they're just kind of laying low until the next morning and things warm up and stuff, and then we can go back home. It seems, again, kind of a risky strategy because you're sitting out there exposed in the open,
right?
You know, and predators and other things could take advantage of it. But I see that quite commonly, too. And as I said, I've often thought it's just a way of just, you know, it's too late to get home and, You know, I've heard this story about the drunk on pollen too, or nectar, yeah. And I just don't think there's enough fermenting nectar out there to do that in most cases.
Well, because I'd be on the plan myself.
Then. There we go.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I wanted to go back to Facebook for a minute because Phoebe sent a photo, and it's a spider in a web, and she said, and it's a really cool photo. She says, can you explain? Please explain the zigzag part of this web, and it is interesting.
Yeah, and to be honest, I know I should know, but I can't pin it down. There is a functional purpose of why orb weavers do that, but it's slipping me right now. So, I mean, again, this is the Argiopa, the black and yellow garden spider we often talk about. And it's interesting. I'm still getting pictures right now in the fall of the year. You get these amazing pictures of a lot of different species of orb weavers. But as I said, I can't remember functionally if this has to do with attracting prey. That seems to be, but I'm not 100% sure. So,
attracting. Yeah, that could be possibly be. And wondering about these bugs. Did we talk?
Yeah, those are the immature box elder bugs.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And then David and DeForest, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I've got about a half an acre woods, three-quarter of an acre woods. And this year, I've had about 20 hickory trees that have just died. They died from the top downwards, and I'm told that some kind of beetle that just attacks hickory trees. You know, we hear a lot about the ash borer, but this is devastating. My whole neighborhood is affected, and it kills the trees very quickly.
So it's the hickory bark beetle, but the issue with that insect is if the trees were happy and healthy, they would not attract the beetle or could defend themselves. And so there's always kind of an underlying stress factor that sometimes is easy to identify and sometimes not. Now, I remember back about 5 or 6 years ago when we went through a couple significant summer droughts, that we had a similar type of experience. And now, if you told me that this is a relatively new construction, the last 5 years or whatnot, my first thing is, you know, construction damaged or root damaged trees often get set up and then these things will move in and it's a 4 or 5 year process to die. In that 5 years ago when we had the drought, the trees that were dying were up on gravel knolls. So they're trees that were particularly drought prone, more so than the trees down in the bottoms that had a little bit better moisture seemed to do fine. So, you know, the thing that I can't identify for you is what has gone on the last 5 to 10 years that may have set these trees up to weaken enough to allow the bark beetles to get a foothold and then take over. Because, as I said, it's not a norm. And it can also be a disease. I mean, we see this in other cases in pines where they get various diseases. And then the bark beetles move in and finish them off. So, as I said, if this continues, you might, if you've got a
certified arborist.
Get an arborist, you know, if it's a woodlot, sometimes you can get a DNR forester to come out and help try to identify what's that factor, because it may be something that you can strengthen the trees and they will fight the fight themselves.
And on that, thanks, David. On that note, Phil, we're out of time. Thank you so much. You'll come back again, I assume. All right, good. Phil Pelletieri, our distinguished faculty associate emeritus professor, as I call him, from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be back. We'll do it again. Tomorrow we'll talk cyber awareness. It's Cyber Awareness Month in October, so we'll talk about keeping your computer and your phone secure with our consumer protection experts. And thanks for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.